And welcome back to Midday. I'm WYPR News Director Matt Bush, sitting in the host seat for Tom Hall. Coming up on the next Midday, Tom is back and ready to learn what you've got cooking this summer. John Shields from Gertrude's Chesapeake Kitchen and Damian Mosley from Black Sauce Kitchen join the show to talk about your favorite summer recipes and ingredients. That's coming up on the next Midday. If you're just joining us now, we're in the middle of the Midday News Wrap. The National Transportation Safety Board released transcripts describing the early morning moment when the Dolly, the ship that struck the Key Bridge, did so in March of 2024. The resulting collapse is one of the worst maritime collisions in U.S. history. It killed six people and has left millions of dollars of economic damages in the Baltimore region. Also, the recent mass overdoses in Penn North continue to challenge city leaders and the behavioral health community. WYPR reporter Scott Massioni is on top of both of these stories, and he joins us in studio right now on the News Wrap to share more details. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
The National Transportation Safety Board, or the NTSB, released transcripts of the crew from the Dolly of that morning that it hit the Key Bridge. Can you tell us when these were released and tell us about what was uncovered in these tapes?
Yeah, these were released in June. However, we've been trying to talk to lots of experts and analysts to kind of break down a lot of the jargon that's been going on within this. You know, crews aren't exactly talking like you and I are talking right now. There's a lot of, pull full to port and things like that. So, once these were released, we saw that there were quite a few interesting pieces within what happened throughout that day and the day before. One was that the ship had lost power the day before, and they had filed a report on that. And then secondly, that throughout this time, that they were having issues with the power, and also with the anchor on the left side of the boat, which caused, really, you would use that as an emergency brake for the ship, and they were having some trouble getting that off of the windlass and getting it down as they were trying to stop the ship before it hit the bridge.
So that morning, the tapes, what do they show on those tapes? What did you hear when you hear the tapes that morning of the short trip that it took from when it left port to when it collided with ran into the Key Bridge?
Yeah, it starts around 1:11 in the morning, and that's when the pilots get onto the ship. And these pilots are people who are experts, who are hired by the port and work for the port, that help these ships traverse really tricky areas like the Port of Baltimore. And these pilots are talking. It's actually very casual. They're asking them what they'd like in their coffee, a little bit of sugar, something like that. Around 1:17, 1:20 in the morning, light music starts to come out through the bridge, and we're hearing that throughout the whole time. This light music is playing from the time that they're really kind of pushing off to the end when the ship collides into the Francis Scott Key Bridge. One of the things that is really striking about this is how quickly that happened. If you noticed, I was just talking about 1:11 to about 1:29 is when they finally say the ship has hit and the Key Bridge is down. It's really a scary thing to read, and also very dramatic scene. How quickly this happens. They are, like I said, getting coffee, listening to music, and then all of a sudden, they lose power. There's alarms blaring throughout this whole ship. They're trying to figure out what's wrong. And then just seconds later, after these alarms, the helmsman reports that he has lost steering. At that point, the ship starts veering right into the Key Bridge. And minutes later, they ask if they can pull the anchor down. They're having trouble with the anchor. And what we've learned through court documents is that that anchor brake was broken and was a two-man job to get the anchor down. They only had one man stationed there at the time. And like I was saying, that's sort of the emergency brake that you would pull on your ship to try and get it to stop. They were unable to do that, and the ship finally hit the bridge. And from there, as you can assume, there's a lot of expletives and a lot of people kind of panicking a bit and trying to figure out if everyone's all right. And as we know, unfortunately, that left six people dead and is now creating a reconstruction project worth $1.7 billion to get the new Key Bridge up and ready. Plans are to get that up by fall of 2028.
and the demolition work is partly going on right now of what remains of the original Key Bridge that's out there. You know, these came out in June, but you spent about a month talking to some national experts about this, because this is obviously going to play a huge role in the court case the state of Maryland has filed. We'll get to that in a second. But you talked to these national experts. They listened to those transcripts. What stood out to them? What did they, when they heard it, they went, wow, that's it? Or what does it, what did they say it shows about the shipping industry?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. I talked to some people who were in the military and then people who were commercial, and they differed quite a bit. The military expert was like, you know, there was bad communication, a lot of sloppy communication. You have to also remember that these people are from either Sri Lanka or Bangladesh, and so there's a mixture of languages happening here, as well as English with the pilots, so there was a little bit of lack of communication within that front. The other things that stood out to them was the lack of power the day before. They had these alarms going off. They filed a report but did not inform the pilots when they got on that the power had gone out the day before. So the pilots weren't really looking for that issue. And then finally, the anchor again. Now, on the commercial side, the commercial captain kind of told me that it was pretty much run-of-the-mill kind of things until the alarms go off. The only thing that really stood out to him, once again, the alarm going off and then the issues with the anchor. So, you know, I think maritime-wise, those are the two things that really are big issues and will definitely be talked about in court when they go about this, figuring out if this ship was seaworthy.
And that's basically what the argument of the state of Maryland in its suit against the owners of the ship is making. That trial is not going to start for another year. Is that correct?
That's right. We're still in the discovery phase. There's a lot going on here. I mean, we have small businesses, large businesses, the city of Baltimore, the state of Maryland, and the federal government has already settled. So all of those entities suing Grace Ocean Private, which is the owner of the Dali, and then also Synergy Maritime Group, which is the manager of the ship. So there's a lot going on there and a lot of discovery. This is going to be thousands and if not millions of pages of documents. And one thing I want to mention is that this trial is going to be broken into two parts. The first part is going to be deciding if there's a liability case. So in many maritime accidents, the federal law, and this goes back to like 1851, says that companies can only be liable for about $44 million. Now, if the ship is proven to be unseaworthy, then that liability cap goes away and it can go up into infinite amounts of money. So that is what the first half of the trial will be addressing. And then after that, the damages will be assessed and the abatement. So those are the two ways they're going to be looking at this. So this is going to be quite a lengthy process. And as I was saying, they're trying to prove, at least the state of Maryland and the city are trying to prove that this ship was not seaworthy as it left the port.
So these transcripts, how does that fit into the argument that the city or the state may be making or the defense that the company may be making?
Yeah, I think it's going to be used by both sides. I mean, this is just really an objective account of what happened and who was talking. So, you know, we're seeing in some ways that the crew was operating as they should, you know, informing the pilots of how they're turning, the mitigation efforts that they took to try and stop the ship from hitting the bridge. But at the same time, you know, as I was saying, there could be sloppy communication they want to point out. They can also point out that the anchor was not working properly as they were trying to drop it, that the alarm went off and they didn't inform the pilots as soon as they got onto the ship. So I think this can be used as many facts can be used as the holder of the facts intends to use them.
You're listening to Midday here on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Matt Bush, the news director for WYPR, sitting in for Tom Hall. I'm speaking with our reporter, Scott Massioni. You can join in the conversation at 410-662-8780 or shoot us an email at midday@wypr.org. Scott, you're also our health reporter. You've been covering the fallout and the follow-up of the Penn North mass overdoses, two separate incidents this month that have happened there. The incident has really encouraged city leaders, first responders, and community organizations to reflect on a coordinated response to the opioid epidemic in the city. Let's take us back to those mass overdose incidences in Penn North this month. The first sickened 27 people, and it really shook the city because as that day went on, the number of people who were had to be hospitalized or were reported to be overdosing just kind of kept growing throughout the day. It eventually got to 27. No one died from that. And then just a few days later, there was a second smaller mass overdose really in the same area. So take us through those. And has a cause for this been determined yet? What was causing these mass overdoses?
Yeah, we haven't gotten an official cause yet, but as you noted, these mass overdoses took an extreme response from the city and from first responders. They had to go through about 170 abandoned buildings to try and ensure that people were safe and look through to make sure there was no one they were leaving behind. 8 different hospitals were taking in people, and not only were these drugs, causing overdoses, but the drugs were so potent that Narcan, the drug that people use to reverse overdoses, once that wore off, people were overdosing a second time. And that was because what this drug does is it blocks your opioid receptors in your body. But once it stops doing that, if there's still opioids in your body, they start to be upticking again. So that was what was happening to those patients at the time. Luckily, no one has died, even though there's been over 30 people now who have overdosed. What the city is telling people is that the drug supply right now is extremely volatile and to be extremely careful. And they're asking people to do harm reduction measures, which means if you are doing opioids, to do them with someone, to have Narcan readily available, to know how to contact your first responders, and to use clean supplies if possible, and to test your drugs for fentanyl and xylazine, any other test strips that you can possibly use. And one other thing I'll note is that the city's still investigating how this happened and what is exactly in the drugs. We do know that NIST has done its own sort of investigation into just samples that they've found on the ground, but we don't know that those are exactly what was used in these overdoses. But those samples were found to have a Valium-like substance in them, which can extremely exacerbate the effects of opioids. And, those drugs themselves can depress breathing and also the nervous system.
So getting a bit of an idea of what the drugs were and what was mixed in with them right now, has anyone been held accountable for this yet? How are these drugs getting into the neighborhood also in Penn North?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know how they're getting in per se or who is behind this. What we've heard from eyewitness accounts is that this was a tester situation. So what drug dealers will do is when they have a new batch of some sort of drug, they'll go to where drug users are and just kind of drop these testers for free for people to use. And then they're essentially used as guinea pigs to see if these drugs, how they're affected, if people like them, if they want to come back for more, to see what the demand is for that. So, the assumption from this, and this, like I said, just an assumption, it's conjecture, is that, there is a chemist that was not very good at their job and put too much of some sort of drug within these sample drugs for people and caused a mass overdose, and just shows you how dangerous these drugs are as they continue to show up not only in opioids but also in stimulants and other illegal drugs.
How's the city been responding to this, having two of these within just about a week of each other and becoming national news because of that? How has the city been responding to this? You've been over in the neighborhood with city officials as they've gone through. What's been going on?
Yeah, there's been a huge outreach within the Penn North area. They set up basically an emergency center where Sarah Whaley, the director of overdose response, had a headquarters there, passing out Narcan test strips, and they literally passed out thousands of these. You could see them just on the street corners where people could grab whatever they needed to. But the problem is that this happened after the overdose, and luckily, when this second overdose happened, those drugs were there to help people if they needed them. But the problem is that not a lot of people are still testing their drugs. It's hard to get people over that hump to kind of get them to do that. So, they're really trying to push for that. The mayor went out in some of the other parts of the city that are known for having larger overdose areas, passing out Narcan and also giving out flyers for what the city's doing with these listening sessions. That's part of a larger effort with the city. As you know, the city is getting hundreds of millions of dollars from opioid settlements. So that money, the city is trying to listen to the communities on how best to spend it and just incorporate that into the way that they're going to be moving forward. Right now, they have about $60 million of that in the next year or two that's been appropriated, give or take. I think it's $50 million in 2026 and maybe 20 to 30 million this year in 2025. And then in addition to that, 86 million will be appropriated to in grants to about 22 different nonprofit organizations like Turk House, which are sort of halfway homes, harm reduction nonprofits, and other recovery nonprofits to help people in the city, get off these drugs, to help overdose response, and to help people who are using drugs do it as safely as possible.
You're listening to Midday here on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Matt Bush, filling in for Tom Hall. We're speaking with our reporter, Scott Massioni, about the mass overdoses that have taken place in the Penn North neighborhood of the city. We've heard about the city officials' response. You got into this a bit, but what about the behavioral health and community organizations over there? There already were some there, which helped in the immediate aftermath of the first mass overdose incident. They were able to respond pretty quickly because some were already in that neighborhood. So what's really been the response for them, and what are they telling people now that we're a few weeks off from both of these happening?
Yeah, once again, that this drug supply is extremely volatile right now, in the sense that the drug, we don't know what's in these drugs, mm-hmm. and you know where they're coming from, which is quite concerning for anyone that is doing them, and for first responders that are trying to respond to it. These recovery centers, Penn North Recovery Center was literally blocks away from where this overdose happened. And I talked to Bill Brooks, the CEO. He said they just basically grabbed Narcan and just helped people as much as they possibly could. The issue with these centers is that and the city council recently had a meeting about this on Wednesday, is that they are often clustered in areas where, there's high amount of drug use, but we're not seeing them in other parts of the city. So you may see one block with multiple behavioral health centers or methadone clinics or, Suboxone clinics. But then if you go a mile down the road, there's not any of them. And it makes it hard for people to get the kind of treatment they need. Another thing is that sometimes these places are only open 9 to 5. And that's one of the biggest things I've been hearing at these listening sessions is if someone is ready to quit drugs, it's usually not between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. It's probably 3 a.m. when you're hitting rock bottom or when you're hitting something, a real health issue. And the resources that people want to get for recovery are not there at the times that the people who are seeking recovery need. So something that the city's probably going to be looking pretty deeply into. One other issue is that the state of Maryland has put a moratorium on some of these behavioral health clinics because they often have been manipulating Medicaid and trying to just kind of get as many people to come through these as possible and get money. Now, that's not by any means all of them. There's just a few, bad actors in here, but enough that the state was concerned and needed to put a moratorium on this. And there's certain zip codes that they have continued this moratorium, especially. So something that we're going to be keeping our eye on here at WYPR is how that these companies go forward and which ones are good actors and which ones aren't so good actors.
And you mentioned this all comes with the backdrop of the city going through these listening sessions and determining how it's going to spend these hundreds of millions of dollars it's won against opioid companies for their distribution of these drugs into the city, and because of the very adverse impact the city has had. So you talked a bit about what people are talking about in these listening sessions, but how much is that, and these two incidents, how much of that might inform the city how this money is going to get spent? Because this is, an influx of money into the city for this particular problem. It's kind of unheard of. What will be the long-term impact of these incidents and these listening sessions and how the city decides to spend all this money it now has?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, the amount of money after legal fees is about $500,000 per citizen of Baltimore. It's an insane amount of money that they could possibly put toward this. So, I talked to Brandon Scott, the mayor, fairly recently as he was walking through the cities. And, he said that they're going to be taking in the ideas from people, these listening sessions. They hired mediators to kind of talk through these listening sessions to ensure that they're more orderly. They write down everything and then are sent to the overdose response agency. We don't know at this point how much they're going to be taking it into account. It's part of the overdose response agency to, look at this and decide how it's going to happen. The city has created quite a robust, you could call it executive structure of how they're going to be using this money. Part of that is creating a trust fund where they'll be getting interest and creating more money to be using. But, you know, they're saying within this that they have to use a certain percentage of money. I believe it's 5% per year to you know, keep the pedal on the metal and make sure that this money is being spent in ways that is helpful for people who are using drugs and to prevent the further use of drugs. And then, you know, we're going to be seeing probably in the fall or maybe toward the end of the year requests for proposals on grants for putting this money out into the city that has not already been earmarked for the $87 million that was within the court cases as they were settled.
Scott Massioni is the health reporter for the WYPR News team. Make sure you continue to follow his coverage of both of these stories at WYPR.org or with the Baltimore Media Public app. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up next on the Midday News Wrap, we'll discuss the town of Crisfield on the Eastern Shore. The elimination of a FEMA grant puts the town's flood mitigation plans at risk. We'll speak with Adam Willis from the Baltimore Banner on this issue. I'm Matt Bush, sitting in the host seat for Tom Hall. More Midday in just a moment. Stay with us.